You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Douglas Wilk joins us now. He's written about music and comics. Douglas Wilk wrote a book on James Brown at the Apollo in the 33 and a third series, books devoted to telling a story behind a single record album. I love those. He wrote Reading Comics, How Graphic Novels Work and What They Mean. And his new book, which you may have heard about, is All of the Marvels, A Journey to the End of the Biggest Story Ever Told, for which he read 27,000 Marvel comics. Douglas Wilk, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
I have read 27,000 comics as well, just not all at once. I started in 1966.
Oh, well done. Good going.
Yeah. So this was really your son's idea.
Yeah, pretty much. He and I started looking at some superhero comics together, and he said, you know, Dad, I'd like to read all the Marvel comics. And I thought, okay, great. This'll last a week. It'll be a nice week we have together. And then a few months later, he'd read a stack of a few hundred, and I started thinking, what would it be like to read the entirety of Marvel as a story? Because it really is one big story. Any part of it can refer to any previous part. All the parts are supposed to be more or less compatible with each other. What would it be like to read that half million page story as a story, to see what it did, to see what it said about the last 60 years of the culture that produced it? And then I ended up spending a few years reading all the time.
How long did it take to read the 27,000?
So reading plus writing the book total was about 5 years.
Now I started reading comics, as I said, when I was 11, and my introduction to Marvel came with, I think it's Spider-Man number 11 or 13, where Unmasked by Dr. Octopus was the first. That was the first one that I had read. And then I started reading, I had already been reading DC. So then I sort of switched over to Marvel's, and have gone back and forth over the years, and I've found good things from both companies, of course. But you're saying that DC, you said in the book that DC is not the same, even though they have interconnected comics, but the continuity is so spread out, it's not the same kind of
thing. DC has relaunched its entire continuity a few times. Yep. They've said, okay, everything before this point doesn't count. We're throwing that out. We're starting fresh, which is fine in its way. And they publish a lot of good stuff, but they don't have that continuous 60 or 80 years of history behind it. The sense that everything that happened in the past matters somehow, and it can continue to matter in the present. And that's something that's really special and pretty much unique about the Marvel story. It's probably true of some soap operas too, but the earlier parts of soap operas don't live, aren't accessible in the same way that this giant comics library is.
Right. You can't go back and watch old episodes, and why would you want to, of The Edge of Night or whatever. So where did you come in when you started reading comics as a kid? I assume that you've been a comic book reader, and I know you worked in a comic shop, you mentioned.
I worked in a comic shop. So I started reading comics, you know, summer of 1979, you know, a little nine-year-old Douglas like picks up an issue of Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and is obsessed and goes back. And then there's another comic that has these characters in it too. Oh, I should get that too. Oh, this one looks interesting too. Oh, I should get that too. Take him home, discover the kid across the street is also a comics kid. I've got Batman and Green Lantern and The Flash. He's got this thing, Daredevil. What's up? Ooh, this is different. Oh, this is different. Oh, I like this too.
That was the Frank Miller era of Daredevil.
It was the Frank Miller era of Daredevil before Frank Miller even started writing it, when he was drawing, when Roger McKenzie was writing. Yeah. And that turned into, oh, there's a store down the street that sells nothing but comics. And so I started going there every single week. And after about 2 years, they're like, you know what? We're just going to teach you to use the register. And, you know, there's a point where most young people who get really into comics decide, oh, it's not really for me anymore. And I'm done. I'm out. That point never came for me. That may be my error, but it never came for me.
Nor I. I've been reading them steadily ever since I was 11.
Yeah.
And I have found them to be, I don't read them to the exclusion of other things, but I've found them to be as at their best, as satisfying a literary experience as anything.
Yeah, they're remarkable. They've stayed with me. They've grown up with me. I go back to a lot of the ones that I read when I was pretty young, and they seem very different for me, and in many ways richer. And that's fantastic. There's not a lot of things that, you know, I was into when I was 10 or 11 that I go back to now. I'm like, oh, I see this differently now. Huh.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I've had that same experience. In fact, I think it was probably been about 20 years ago, but I decided to read Spider-Man 1 through 100 again.
Yeah.
And it was such a satisfying experience. And I think that I've always been disappointed in the Marvel movies. I mean, I enjoy the Marvel movies, but I don't think they're anywhere near as good as the books. Maybe Into the Spider-Verse came closest to being kind of a...
I love Into the Spider-Verse. I really like the Marvel movies. I kind of even think of them as a totally separate category from the comics. Like they're not adaptations of the comics. They're not supposed to be. They are a different medium. They use a lot of the material of the comics as this enormous supermarket from which they can assemble anything they want. And they're really good at that. I really liked WandaVision. One of the reasons I really liked WandaVision is that it is so specifically a television program.
And a homage to other television programs.
Yeah, and it leans into that instead of being like, oh, there's this comic and then we made a live action film of it. No,
right.
It is its own thing, and I love that.
Oh, I loved the Tom King Vision
run.
That was fantastic.
Yeah. You know,
maybe we'll get too esoteric, but who cares? One of the things I love about your book, and it struck me right away, is that you gave Lee third billing. I mean, almost anybody ever talking about comics, Marvel Comics, says Stan Lee created these characters along with Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko. And you say Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko along with Stan Lee. Have you gotten any pushback on that?
Not really. I mean, there are Stan Lee partisans. There are Jack Kirby partisans there. What I think is interesting is that their work came from creative collaboration. And it's pretty undeniable if you look at it that Kirby and Ditko did a lot of the heavy lifting there, because the way that they made their comics, this is not something that is terribly widely known. Like, comics people know it, people outside of comics don't. The Marvel method, as Stan Lee called it, was that he didn't write a full script when he was working on a comic. He would sometimes write, you know, a plot synopsis, or sometimes have a plot conference with an artist and get up on his desk and act out the story, or sometimes just suggest a few elements that should go into a story, or after a certain point with Kirby and Ditko especially, just leave the story up to them altogether. And then they would draw it, and he would add dialogue and captions. And there's a fantastic book about the relationship between Kirby and Lee called Stuff Said. And it's STUF apostrophe said. I don't know why it's called that. But it compiles pretty much every documentation of either Kirby or Lee in the 60s talking about their creative process. And whenever one of them uses the word writing, it's in red, because they use that word so completely differently that both of them believe themselves to be the person who was writing those comics. And by their definition, that's what they did, because Kirby said, you know, writing is coming up with what happens in the story and putting it on paper and, you know, staging it and blocking it. And that's what I do. I write the stories. And Stan Lee said, no, writing is picking the words, the language that you see that's on the page. That's what I do. I write the stories. So
they could both make claim to writing in their own definition of writing.
Yeah. And so, I mean, both of them are 100% correct by their own lights. I think I mentioned in the book that their relationship was, you can even say, like, you know, that Daryl Hall and John Oates, you know, one of them is the person who's the primary creative force, who's really doing the pyrotechnic stuff. And the other one is the one without whom the magic doesn't happen.
No, I see that. I mean, one of the arguments, I guess, that people can make is that neither none of them, Lee, Ditko, or Kirby, created as they continued to create characters when they weren't working together, but none of them created characters nearly as memorable as the characters that they created together.
No. And if you look just at their work, the period when pretty much anybody was working with Stan Lee in the 60s, every artist who worked with him became a much better and more interesting and more distinctive artist over the course of that decade. Because among other things, he was an absolutely fantastic editor and art director. He could bring out what was within artists. And Kirby famously became much more estranged from Lee later on and said, you know, he just stole all my credit. You know, I've never seen that guy write anything. And if you look at what other artists who were working with Lee said, they say that my favorite quote is one from John Romita, who said, like, oh, yeah, he was a con man for sure, but he did deliver. A con man who delivers the goods. That's exactly what Stan Lee is.
a revelation I found in your book, All of the Marvels, Douglas Wolk, is when you said that the Marvel universe, beginning with Fantastic Four number one, is really a combination of three genres: the superhero genre, which had existed since the 1940s, and the monster comics that had been so popular in the 50s, and the romance comics, also created by Jack Kirby, which had also been really popular, and a neglected genre for sure. And you can really see that, I think, when you look not only at the Fantastic Four, but when you look at Romita's run on Spider-Man, there's a lot of romance comic stuff in there. And I'd never thought of that before, that it's that merger of those three genres.
Yeah, it's those. I mean, Romita was a romance comics artist before he was a superhero comics artist. Like, you could tell he just wanted to draw pretty girls crying. Like, that was his thing. And in the late 60s, Marvel briefly revived Our Love Story and My Love, old romance titles. And Romita drew a bunch of stories for them. And you could tell he just poured himself into them. He loved drawing this stuff. But all of that went into it. The monster comics went into it. They never went away. The humor comics. Stan Lee had been writing comedy comics for 15, 20 years when he starts writing superhero comics. He's still writing. He was writing Millie the Model for another 10 years. And that's in there, too. The lightness and comedy and banter and verbal humor. I mean, what's Volstagg from Thor if not, like, the great comedy foil of that decade?
Oh, yeah. And, of course, you know, Spider-Man is the funniest superhero ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though he's miserable and filled with angst, he still finds time to make a joke.
I mean, most comedians are.
Yeah, I found that really interesting. Looking back, I enjoyed reading all of those comics, too. I love the monster comics, and I love the romance comics as well as superhero comics. And you actually, so you really found the starting point for the Marvel saga a little bit earlier than Fantastic Four number one.
Yes, indeed. Linda Carter's Student Nurse number one, which came out 2 months before Fantastic Four number one, was the first comic to have the MC logo on its first issue. MC may have stood for Marvel Comics or not. Nobody remembers. The Marvel Comics name wasn't in use until 1963. It was just a bunch of stuff published by a bunch of different publishing companies that were all at the same address and had the same people working for them. But Linda Carter is one of a group of comics that Marvel was publishing then, or the company was publishing then, that were about young professional women and teenage girls. And there were a bunch of them. And 4 months later, 2 months after the first Fantastic Four, there's the first multiple title crossover. And it doesn't have any superheroes in it. It is about Linda Carter, student nurse, and Kathy the Teenage Tornado, and Millie the Model, and Patsy Walker, America's sweetheart, and her friend Heidi. And they're comic, like, there's events from some that have a little bit of payoff in others, and it's what they were doing with superhero comics starting a few years after that. But it's in these comics about young women, which gradually went away over the course of the 60s, but never went away entirely. Linda Carter's comic lasted 9 issues. Linda Carter's Student Nurse, I should clarify, is not a good comic. It's a really interesting, it's not a good comic. But Linda Carter turns up again. She turns up in a comic called Night Nurse in the early 70s. She turns up again in the early 2000s in Daredevil as a nurse running a clinic for injured superheroes. She starts dating Doctor Strange.
Yeah. If the value of comics were truly based on their rarity, the Night Nurse number one would be one of the all-time most.
It's special to me. Every comic is special to somebody. Everybody, every little story has somebody who imprinted on it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Douglas Woke. He has just written a new book. It's called All of the Marvels, A Journey to the Ends of the Biggest Story Ever Told. In the process of writing the book, Douglas Woke read 27,000 Marvel comics and discovered that they are all interconnected. Is it a drawback, Douglas Woke, for new readers that to truly understand this month's issue of X-Men, you have to know 50 years of X-Men history?
It is and it isn't. I mean, I mentioned in the book that one of the really fun things about getting into comics is the joy of being confused and then finding your way out of confusion. The moment when you're like, oh, I get it now. Oh, I didn't understand this, and now I do understand it. That's cool, like, no matter what context it's in. Smart comics, comics that are really well written, will often tell you everything you need to know without telling you that they're telling you that. The relaunch of X-Men, actually, a couple of years ago, the Jonathan Hickman House of X, Powers of Ten. It's a fantastic comic, and one of the brilliant things about it is that it is written so that people who have never read an X-Men comic before can pick it up and get what's going on, and people who've been reading X-Men comics for 40 years can pick it up and see the payoff for all this stuff that's been happening for decades, and people who read X-Men for 10 years and then haven't been reading for 20 years can pick it up and go, oh, that's cool, that's different. That's a juggling act. That's a high wire routine, but he pulls it off.
I do think the best writers can do that. I always loved Alan Moore's work, and at DC, for instance, when he did Swamp Thing, he tweaked the character in such a way as to not change the origin story, but just reinterpret the origin story so that the comic could go off in an entirely new direction. That being that before that, Swamp Thing was Dr. Alec Holland trapped in this body of the Swamp Thing, and Alan Moore fixed it so that he wasn't Alec Holland. He just happened to have Alec Holland's memories, but he was in fact a swamp creature.
Yeah.
And that little tweak was pretty great idea. I think he did a similar thing with Adam Strange, who's the beam that takes him to the planet, whatever it is, wasn't an accident and it wasn't random.
Yeah.
And I like that. And I think we mentioned Frank Miller. He was really good at doing that as well, both with Daredevil and with Batman later too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are some of your favorite runs?
My favorite runs. Wow. I love that. I go into the book for a while, the Master of Kung Fu from 1973, 1983, insanely problematic comic in a lot of ways, also great. It is so smart and so beautiful and so thoughtful and also so problematic that it was fascinating to go back and wrestle with it. Like, it rewards wrestling with it. I love that. I love the long Chris Claremont run on X-Men from 1975 to 1991. He wrote it for 16 years straight, and it just did things with character and with change and with being willing to completely change the premise of the series itself every few months. Nobody'd ever attempted anything like that before, and it's just inspirational. There are little things I really like. You know, I talked about my fondness for Squirrel Girl. I love the Matt Fraction, David Aja Hawkeye series. Jim Starlin's Warlock stories in the 1970s blew my mind when I read them, you know, as a 11, 12 year old. And then blew my mind all over again when I came back to them as a 30-year-old, and then blew my mind all over again in still a different way when I came back to them as a 45-year-old. There's a lot of special stuff out there like that.
I hadn't read Ms. Marvel until I read your book, All of the Marvels, and I said, oh, that sounds interesting. And so I read the first bunch of issues, and I found it to be pretty fascinating stuff. Well written.
It's lovely. It's G. Willow Wilson is writing and Adrian Alfona is drawing it first. The current Ms. Marvel, who's getting her own TV show next year, she is a Pakistani-American Muslim teenager living in Jersey City who, as these things happen in the Marvel story, gets powers that she never asked for, never wanted, and decides that she needs to figure out how to do good in the world with them. But this, you know, it conflicts with her interest in being a good student. It conflicts with her very conservative family. And she has to kind of find her way in the world. That's the Peter Parker story. That is the Spider-Man story. That is that particular how is this character going to grow up archetype for right now. And it's so gorgeous.
Yeah, it's interestingly drawn in a way too. I mean, the characters are oftentimes vague and very very hand drawn feeling to them.
Yeah, and even the panel borders are hand drawn, which is something that you never ever see in mainstream comics. It's something that you see in art comics and underground comics, and you haven't really seen it much in mainstream comics before now. And Adrian Alfona ruling the borders of these panels by hand is a way of communicating the idea that, like, yeah, this is kind of like those other things you've seen, but it's a little different. It's very handmade.
Yeah. Well, so recently there's some controversy about sexuality and gender identity and so forth in comic books. And I don't know why people are upset about it because, you know, they're drawings. But nevertheless, where do you fall? How do you feel about this controversy?
The more of it, the better. The more sexual diversity and gender diversity and presentation diversity that you can have in comics, the better. The more it is like the world around it, the more it can tell stories about the world around it, the better comics get. And you know, comics were a little bit slow to the post in some ways to get in, and also kind of not. Like, you see the first same-sex couple showing up in Marvel's comics around, like, you see the first same-sex couple showing up in Marvel's comics around, like, 1973, 1974. There's a couple different candidates for that. They're not in super high profile comics. There's one that's, you know, in the Black Panther serial. There's one that is in, I want to say, yeah, The Living Mummy, Supernatural Thrillers, has Old Dan and the Asp. They are like not very, very strongly implied. You have a gender fluid character pretty early on with Mystique and X-Men. The first trans superhero shows up in Squirrel Girl. It is Koi Boy, who is not even signaled to be trans until like a year into the series. There's a scene where everybody is, you know, changing into their superhero outfits, and somebody tweeted the artist and was like, wait, is Koi Boy wearing a binder? And the artist was like, well, we didn't want to make a very special episode out of it or anything, but yeah, I mean, that was built in. Like, that's fantastic. I love that.
I'm Gary Shapiro. I'm Gary Shapiro. You are listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and my guest this week is Douglas Woke. He has just written a brand new book. It's called All of the Marvels, A Journey to the Ends of the Biggest Story Ever Told, and it is all about the interconnectedness of Marvel Comics. And in preparation for the book, Douglas Woke read 27,000 Marvel Comics. Douglas Woke, I want to ask you about the depiction of the female characters in comic books. They have always been scantily clad, hypersexualized, unnecessarily brutalized, stereotyped.
It is changing. And having more people who are not like the same group of white dudes, like middle-aged white dudes making comics, is helping to change that a lot. There are more women creators than there have been in a while. Marvel had women creators starting in the 60s, but in a very, very limited way. In the 70s, a little tiny bit more. in the 80s, significantly more. You had people like Ann Nesenti, who's fascinating, and Louise Simonson writing comics. And now Kelly Sue DeConnick. Kelly Sue DeConnick made the Captain Marvel as we know her in the movie. Like, that is Kelly Sue DeConnick doing a massive revamp job on a familiar character. And as more women start writing and drawing comics, we're starting to see some better representation. And, you know, it's not caught up. It's still sometimes pretty problematic, but it's moving the right way. I would like to see it move more the right way.
Yeah. Of course, the male body is also impossibly drawn, but people don't care about that as much.
And also, like, specifically sexualized, not quite as much in the same ways. But yeah, I mean, there is that.
Yeah, Kirby said once that you can put all kinds of muscles in, it doesn't matter if those muscles are real or not, because who knows anything about muscles?
Thank you, Jack Kirby. Your legacy endures to this day in Comics Anatomy.
Yeah, so I'm one of those people that you mentioned in your book who are put off by interconnected spanning stories like Ultimate Crisis on the Earths of
Rome. Right.
But you embrace those. You like those.
I do like those. I mean, partly it's how my brain works, right? I like seeing the pieces of the story fit together. I think the way that they've been done in mainstream comics in the last 10-15 years has really changed and really gotten to be better a lot of the time. You used to see the problem that, like, either you had to buy all 37 parts of a story to see how it worked, or you would buy 37 parts of a story and 32 of them would be entirely irrelevant to it. And the way that comics crossovers works now is most often on a kind of hub and spoke model. So there'll be, you know, a central miniseries, War of the Realms, whatever, and then there'll be issues of ongoing series that connect to that. So, you know, if you're interested in what the Guardians of the Galaxy are doing that relates to the story, then you read that story. And if you're not interested in what the Guardians of the Galaxy are doing, then don't read it. There'll be spinoffs for you. If you want to see more about how this event is affecting things across this fiction landscape, then there are these. If not, you get to pick the paths that you want. And the really clever creators are the ones who can do tie-ins to massive stories that don't depend on that massive story, or that use that massive story to get their story, their own story, where it's going.
I wonder if creators get annoyed if they're in the middle of drawing a run of Captain America and they're suddenly told by the powers that be that their story now has to include whatever the main story is.
I don't think that even happens so much anymore. You will very often see, there'll be a Captain America : crossover title of crossover thing that will be running at the same time as the regular Captain America series, so it doesn't, quote, interrupt it. But you'll also see things like, there's that lovely Loki Agent of Asgard series about 5 years ago, where I think 2/3 of the issues of that series were crossovers with something or other. And you can also read it entirely on its own without any of the stuff it's connecting to. And it makes perfect sense. And if you're reading it in conjunction with those other stories, you see what the force is that's pushing the story where it was always meant to get to.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I mean, there's been a lot of books about comic book history, but I think your book is the first one to just deal, primarily and wholly with what's actually transpiring in the comic books. And I love that about it. It's a marvelous book. It was really great, and I recommend it to everybody. All of the Marvels, A Journey to the Ends of the Biggest Story Ever Told, and the author, Douglas Wilk. Thanks so much for hanging out with me and talking on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. This was a real pleasure, and let me know if I can do anything to be helpful in the future.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.